Good afternoon. I'm Ross Reynolds. This is the Week in Review. I'm in for Bill Radke with Emily Parkhurst, editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal, Essex Porter, a reporter at Cairo 7 News, and Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail. Welcome to you all.
Hi there.
Good to be here.
Major news from the Supreme Court this week. Huge news. We're going to spend a little time on everything that went on there. Of course, the biggest news, perhaps, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy announcing he's retiring. This gives President Trump a rare opportunity to name a second Supreme Court justice, which could tilt the country's highest court to the right for a generation. It's raising fears among some that conservatives could overturn Roe versus Wade, the decision that legalized abortion. Now, we don't know who's going to be the president nominee to take Justice Kennedy's seat. But based on past behavior, we can assume it's going to be someone not acceptable to the Democrats. Do they have any traction here at all when it comes to this nominee who we hear is going to be before the court this coming fall?
The problem is for the Democrats, they do not have the right number of votes. President Trump has been meeting already with Democrats who come from states where he won. And I'm talking about Donnelly from Indiana, Manchin from West Virginia, and Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota. Now, there are some Republican senators who are known to be, because this is about choice quite a bit, pro-choice. So that is, I don't see how the numbers work for the Democrats. This, as we can all talk about how Mitch McConnell has sort of changed the rules of the game here in a very kind of awful way. The McConnell rule, as you know, is just came about in 2016, where he was unwilling to honor President Obama's nomination. Justice Scalia died in February. Opening for Justice Kennedy comes at the end of June. It is effective, in July. Seems pretty weird that he just keeps changing the rules to benefit Republicans. I think it's absolutely despicable to think that this person, who just because he schedules Senate votes and things like that, can cause so much trouble and change basically the rules of democracy.
And what about these fears that we'll see the recriminalization of abortion? Essex, do you think that these are overblown?
Well, probably overblown for Washington State, where voters codified Roe v. Wade. So it is state law. What happens, what is expected to happen is that the Supreme Court will simply throw the question back to the states. And there are states that would want to criminalize abortion. So it could happen in some states, probably not likely here in Washington State.
Well, and I think one of the other concerns here is that a lot of those states that you're talking about, Essex, they're all close together. And so that could mean a huge swath of the United States where women aren't able to get access to a lot of these services. And that could be one of the outcomes of this.
Emily Parkhurst, how's this going to play out politically? Obviously, Democrats are going to try to use this to energize voters to gain a Democratic majority in the House and maybe the Senate in the midterm elections this fall. But is that kind of energy going to be counteracted by the fact that abortion opponents are going to be really fired up?
Yeah, that was one of the first things that I thought of when I saw the news that this is going to bring out maybe more of the Republicans that might have sat out this time around. And I think that's interesting. One of the other things, I'm from Maine originally, and so Susan Collins is always interesting to me to watch. I grew up, with her in the Senate representing us, and I think she's
the Republican who's often supported Democratic.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And Olympia Snowe was there when I was living in Maine, and she was also kind of considered a moderate. And I think Collins is really trying to make a play to run for governor, and in Maine, and I think that. Is going to play into her decision on how to play this Supreme Court.
Also at the Supreme Court, justices upheld the third version of President Trump's travel ban issued back in September. It restricts entry from 7 countries to varying degrees. They are Iran, North Korea, Syria, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and Venezuela. Now, observers say this reaffirms the president's sweeping power when it comes to deciding who can and cannot travel in the United States. And it also paves the way for more aggressive immigration restrictions. Now, one argument that the president made was that these countries don't reliably vet their citizens coming to the U.S., leaving us vulnerable to terrorists and criminals coming into the country. How do we evaluate that claim, Joni?
We're not going to be able to evaluate that claim. This is going to be the law of the land. The ruling really was that a president has fairly broad powers to conduct national security. A lot of folks, no, look, this is a 5-4 decision. Get used to that term, 5-4 decision. Because when you see those, you know that it could just have easily have gone the other way. And I will point out that our state attorney general, Bob Ferguson, says this wasn't his case. This was the Hawaii case. This was slightly different. But this is going to be the law of the land if you realize that this is what the justices have said here.
Well, it has always been the law of the land that the president has very broad powers when it comes to immigration. But Congress also limited those powers so that he cannot discriminate on the basis of ethnicity or race or nationality. And that's what came in play in this case. And it was interesting to me that all the things that President Trump said that many people believe are anti-Muslim were deliberately put aside by the majority here. But so it was like he wasn't discriminating against religion. But in the Masterpiece Bakers case, where the baker didn't want to bake a wedding cake for the gay couple, the court said, well, the religion of the baker was attacked. That was important. That's why we're sending this back to Colorado for a different decision. And that's why they're also sending the similar case here, Arlene's Flowers, back for a different decision to see if religion came into play. So religion apparently has no impact on the travel ban, but it has a lot of impact on other cases.
Well, Chief Justice Roberts wrote, he did acknowledge Trump's many comments, most of them in his favorite medium of Twitter, that they did reveal sort of what was in his heart about the religion of these folks, these Muslim, predominantly Muslim countries. But he said that has to be balanced against the broad powers of the president to conduct national security. So he was acknowledging it, but saying—
But he just put it aside.
But he said, this is bigger.
Okay,
this is bigger.
There's yet another major story from the Supreme Court this week. We're not even going to get to all of them, but they ruled that government workers who are represented by a union but choose not to join do not have to pay to cover the costs of collective bargaining. The court found that these payments clash with individual rights because they violate, quote, the free speech rights of non-members by compelling them to subsidize private speech on matters of public concern. Now, Washington State is a highly unionized state. Many influential unions representing public workers, the Service Employees International Union, instrumental in getting $15 an hour pay, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also on the losing side of the Supreme Court decision, very influential in our state. Emily Parkhurst, what kind of impact might this ruling have here?
You know, I think it's interesting. The SEIU is very strong here and has been for a very long time. And this is a fairly strong union state, even beyond the public sector into the private sector, when you think about the union workforce at Boeing. I don't anticipate a massive impact here in Washington State because I do think that the unions here will remain fairly strong. And if you look at their relationships with the folks in political positions of power here, there's a lot of power in that relationship too.
But might this not hurt them financially, Essex Porter?
Well, that's exactly where this was
right. Aimed.
This is exactly like the reason why groups like the Freedom Foundation here in Washington State and other conservative groups nationwide have been pushing this to the court to finally get the decision they wanted, because they really want to undermine the financial underpinnings of unions. I went to the rally that unions had right after this. People constantly assured me that this would have a little impact on their union, that in fact unions in this state, anticipating the loss, have been talking with their members and explaining the benefits of union membership and why they should keep paying their dues. I think we'll know, you know, when dues come up in about a year, whether people will continue to voluntarily pay them.
What do you think about this, Joni? Will this hurt our unions in this state?
I think it can't help but hurt. It has to hurt because, you know, it really does say to some of the people who don't want to participate, you don't have to contribute anymore. Now, there was a really good piece in the Seattle Times. One of the authors was a former congressional candidate, Brady Pinheiro Walkinshaw, who made a pretty darn good case about the way that unions, the public, you know, firefighters, police officers, how all these folks would be affected by this. But there is something in here, and this maybe won't be that popular here, there is something in here for me that makes me feel like, look, if you don't want to be in the union and you still have to pay, there's something unfair about that. But I also don't think that you should benefit from what the union folks go out and get for you.
And that's the counterargument. You're getting a free ride if you don't pay anything to the
union. And I don't think that's right, and I don't think this rectifies that, if I understand.
Well, and we should stipulate, too, the president put out some kind of false information suggesting that these union dues were going to support the other political activities of unions, of which there are many. Unions are in all kinds of areas. In fact, the law specifically prohibits union dues from going to other political activities. It's supposed to only cover the amount of union work that is for collective bargaining. Although I got to wonder, how do you know?
Well, in fact, you know, I interviewed one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit here locally to get rid of the requirement to pay union dues. And he said, you know, his union is the Washington Federation of State Employees. He says, because we are the people who work for the taxpayers, everything my union does is political. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't agree with what his union does, and that's why he sued, so he does not have to pay even what they call the agency fee for being represented in collective bargaining.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see how this plays out in our state with many unions who might be affected by it as the future goes forward. Emily Parkhurst is with us. She's editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal, Essex Porter, reporter at Cairo 7 News, and Joni Balter. You see her on Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. It's the Week in Review. Coming up, we're going to be talking about that horrible newsroom shooting, how the trade wars might be affecting us in Washington State. Also, Western State Hospital, it's lost its federal certification. That's going to mean big costs for the state. And the streetcar named Fail. All that coming up on Week in Review.
Good one.
Hey, thanks for joining us. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke on The Week in Review, joined today by Emily Parkhurst, editor at the Puget Sound Business Journal, Essex Porter from Cairo 7 News, and Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. Also, you can tweet at us at KUOW. Kara McDermott's here to see what you have to say, and she'll share it with us. Five people were killed in a shooting Thursday at the Capital Gazette newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland. President Trump had to say this about it this morning.
Journalists, like all Americans, should be free from the fear of being violently attacked while doing their job.
Well, we don't know the details of this, but it appears as though, unlike the murders at the French magazine Charlie Hebdo, this was not a politically motivated killing. As I say, we don't know all the details. This person who's the suspect, had a grudge against the paper for some stories it did about him. Emily Parkhurst, what do we make of this random act of violence, a stand-in for the public's low regard for journalists? What are your thoughts?
I hope not. I mean, it's such a horrific thing. And of course, you know, as a journalist myself, being connected to lots of other journalists, everybody was just sort of pouring their heart out the past day talking about this. You know, I think one of the questions that I received as soon as I walked in the office today was, what's our security like? What's our building like? Yeah, we have our locked front door, but it's made of glass. Should we be changing that? And I think that I don't know that that's necessarily commentary on the state of journalism right now. I don't think that that's anything new, frankly. You know, I've worked at newspapers for years and we've had myriad threats over those years. I've personally had threats of violence against me many times. And, you know, I think that this brings to light the danger that journalists face every day, no matter how innocuous their beat may be. It doesn't necessarily matter. You don't have to be in a war zone covering that war zone in order to be threatened.
Essex Porter, is there not a certain, at least, irony to the president talking about reporters being able should be able to do their job when he was at his rallies calling out the press and actually directing the audience's ires at the press at those events?
Well, it's more than irony. It's dangerous. President Trump has also called reporters the enemy of the people. And he said some nice words this morning, but I haven't heard him apologize for calling reporters the enemy of the people. He has used his pulpit to raise and direct anger at journalists. And while this particular incident may or may not have been tipped over by this, it has certainly made the job of being a reporter, of being a journalist, more dangerous. The president, whoever that president is, does set the tone in this country. And one statement this morning doesn't change that tone.
Joni Balter.
President Trump is at least 10 different people in any given day. And so he was able to give the statement that you're referring to. And then he could easily go to a rally tonight or tomorrow and restate that journalists are the enemy of the people. You know, this is not, probably not, we don't know, a reflection of his words exactly. This is a person who had a grudge against this paper about, you know, something they published a few years ago, had threatened the paper for quite some time. We have to be concerned in this country about this template of rage. It actually has, like, here's what you do when you're really mad. And it just is repeated over and over again because we're just plain stupid about guns here. We are as a country. It's just repeated way too often. You know, I'm not ready to assign blame. I think the civility issues in this country are so dramatic. We've got to get this under control. We really do, how we speak about each other and to each other and this sort of whole tribal thing that is quite outrageous.
Well, I do have to wonder if some of this is the dehumanization of journalists and kind of what Essex, what you were saying, that Trump, you know, in some of his statements has successfully dehumanized reporters and journalists and even mocked them in that way. And does that contribute to somebody who's already angry and frustrated by a group of journalists to turn violent?
He's dehumanized all kinds of different groups,
exactly,
of workers, employees, and people of different faiths.
Notwithstanding this violence, I don't know that journalism is one of the most dangerous professions in the country. However, those of us who work at and or have worked at organizations know that people know where we are. And certainly here at KUOW, we've gotten active shooter training, flee, hide, fight, in that order. What has been happening? You can't just stroll into Cairo TV, can you?
No, you can't. But I think certainly at Cairo TV, I believe management will look at even more how we can be both passively and actively protected.
So many, many news organizations, you cannot get into them very easily. You remember years ago, there was something that happened out in front of Como. Mm-hmm. And then these barricades were put up because somebody was like driving a car.
Well, actually, this was at Channel 5. This was at King. Someone who was angry drove, I believe, their truck through the front
That's
door
right,
into
right,
the
yeah.
lobby, crushed the legs of one of the reporters there. And that's when they commissioned really a sculpture that kind of looked nice, but its real role was to be a concrete barricade to keep that from happening again.
And out in front of Como, they put up these boulders. You cannot get in. And many of the news organizations, national, small, bigger, have quite a sophisticated security system. It turns out they need it.
Yeah, absolutely. You can tweet at us at KUOW for your thoughts on any of these stories. We're going over the week in review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel Civic Cocktails, with us, along with Essex Porter from Cairo 7 News and Emily Parkhurst, editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal. Up ahead, more of what happened this week. It's the Week in Review on KUOW.
When we're $500 billion down, they say Trump is starting a trade war. I say no. The trade war ended a long time ago, and the United States lost because our leaders didn't take care of our people and our companies.
President Trump at a rally in Fargo, North Dakota this week. Washington is one of the most trade-dependent states in the union. Hence, President Trump's recently declared trade war has implications for our state. KUOW hosted Marketplace's Kai Rizdahl this week, and he gave this thought about the impact of the trade war here.
Seattle is sort of a special case, right? Because you guys have a couple of really big companies, which, while trade reliant, are not trade dependent, right? I mean, Amazon's going to be fine. Microsoft is going to be fine. Boeing is going to be fine, unless airplane tariffs come in, which, forget it. The people to worry about are people like Patrick Smith, who's my apple farmer. But he's the guy who's screwed, right? Because, as you've heard him say on Marketplace, you can't make apple trees not grow apples. And when the Mexicans are putting tariffs on, when we've been pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which takes us out of the China market, which Patrick Smith has told me he was counting on, what's he going to do? So all his fruit's going to go into a lower category of priceable goods, right? And it's going to go to juices instead of farm stand and supermarket sales, right? It's going to go to the lower margin stuff. he's going to be hosed.
Well, President Trump said a trade war is going to be easy for us to win, but our state's biggest foreign trading partner, Canada, has announced countermeasures against U.S. imports. They're going into effect on this Sunday. They include Canadian tariffs on steel and aluminum, coffee, motorboats, and sailboats coming from the U.S. and, of course, coming from Washington State. Emily Parkhurst, what do you think the impact of the trade war will be on our state?
You know, I think that part of what Kai was saying was that these big companies that we have here that we associate with Washington State, they're going to be fine. And I think that's probably true unless, like you said, airplanes suddenly have a tariff on them and then we're in trouble. But I think the smaller companies, and also there's a lot of companies in Washington State that cater to those smaller companies. There's a whole trickle down a part of this that is getting left out. There's all the companies that negotiate these trades. There's companies like Expeditors International that deal with the logistics of all of that. And those are massive companies here. And it's a big, big business. And so it's not just the apple farmers, but it's everybody who arranges for those apples to get on a plane and go to China.
Sure.
And so that whole business is also impacted. Plus, you've got the cherries rotting on the vine, and that has an impact further down the ladder.
Essex and Joni, there's the what of how this might impact us, and then there's the when. Are we seeing any signs that the trade war is already affecting Washington State businesses?
I think what's interesting is that President Trump, when he talks like that at the rally, sounds like he thinks this is something that he can choreograph, that he can stage, and he cannot. This is, you know, people react differently. Like, he got the big surprise of the week there when Harley Davidson said, okay, you know, everything was hunky-dory here except for your little trade war is causing us to move some of our operations to Europe. We're not gonna stay here. This doesn't bode well for us. And so I don't think he can control this. And also, there's some indication that the trading partners are, you know, very eager to sort that they're playing politics very carefully. So they want to pick things, in states that actually voted for Trump. It's just to kind of say back at you. And, you know, like whiskey's an example of that.
Well, but they've been doing that for years. Yeah. I mean, that's what trade wars do, is these countries will specifically target the areas that voted for the person and who's made the decision to do the trade wars. I mean, we've seen that before.
I mean, I just wouldn't be so confident as Kai Ryssdal was about Boeing, because, you know, Boeing can be under attack from a lot of different ways. Maybe there's not a tariff on airplanes, but then, you know, it is governments who control a lot of the airlines who buy Boeing aircraft, and they might just decide to buy Airbus instead.
Or just build their own, like China's doing.
Yeah. Or, you know, and of course, raising the price of aluminum and steel. A lot of aluminum goes into planes. They're not all plastic yet.
Now, I was doing a little research on this a week or so ago, and I looked at Nucor Steel. They run a steel facility here in Seattle, and they had a press release out nationally applauding the president's tough trade policy. Are there businesses or groups in Washington State that could benefit from a trade war? Emily, what do you think?
Certainly some. The example that you gave is perfect, but I think that's going to be, you know, outweighed by just the sheer number of businesses that will be hurt by it. And then you also have to keep into account, you know, as Essex said, there's a lot of things that are made with the products that are that have all these tariffs on them, including a lot of the buildings that are going up in downtown Seattle. If the price of steel goes up dramatically, is that going to affect development here, which in turn will affect how many apartment buildings get built, which will in turn affect how much the price of the apartments are?
But I think Kai Ryssdal is on mark when he talks about Eastern Washington and how
exactly.
Much. So we're talking, you know, hay, alfalfa. I read a story about how that is just, you know, up in the air, and definitely with much of the fruit.
Do we see a weird crossover here? I mean, I can remember back from the WTO days, a lot of Seattle liberals and leftists were against the kind of trade agreements that were in place. Is there a certain crossover here between the left and the right when it comes to what Trump's saying about how we're being taken advantage of? He generally uses it as an economic argument, and those against those trade agreements generally tended to go towards, oh, this is bad for the environment, or this is bad for workers.
Well,
is there a connection here?
Well, as long as the state has been as trade-dependent as it has been, you've had your Democrats being pro-trade in this state because of just the economic makeup of the state.
They have to be, right?
Yeah, have to be.
Let's move on to another story, big story this week. Federal officials announced that Western State Psychiatric Hospital in Lakewood going to lose its federal certification. That means $53 million in funding. The money spigot closes Sunday. So to keep Western open, state government's going to have to find $53 million to make up the difference. Federal inspectors have been dinging the hospital for the past 3 years for not acting to reduce the risk of patient suicide and for incidents of patients injuring hospital staff and each other. They've found that Western has failed to keep adequate medical records, they failed to adopt quality control measures for nursing care, and they failed to implement doctor-ordered treatment plans. Here's DSHS spokesperson Adolfo Capistani.
I would say we came up short, but I would not say that we failed those families. Those patients are still being treated for the conditions that they have, and that does not change today. The staff doing the day-to-day work on treating those patients do not diminish their efforts because of this announcement.
Well, the Seattle Times disagrees. They wrote, quote, in their editorial, almost 6 years into his tenure as governor, Governor Inslee deserves the blame for the state's mental health debacle that his administration has lacked the urgency to address for way too long. Fair criticism, Joni Balter?
Well, you know, look, the Seattle Times has not been a big fan of Jay Inslee, if you think about it. Jay Inslee's been governor for quite some time. This problem has festered for many years. There was a 2014 audit report. You know, this place needs to get its act together. It is a pretty big blemish on the Washington miracle that Jay Inslee may want to sell when he runs for president slash climate czar.
There's certainly been a lot of reports over the years when Essex has just been in action on government, allowing this to fester. And
no, I think the spokesperson in one sense had the tone right. It's not as if they have not been trying. They have not. The federal government dinged them for not trying hard enough and accomplishing things fast enough. And so the state will have to come up with the additional money necessary to accomplish what the federal government says is necessary, and they will have to do it faster.
But I don't think this is a money problem down there. I think this is a leadership management problem. There's no evidence they don't have enough money. There's plenty of evidence they don't know how to manage what they have.
And that was what the report cited, was that it was a leadership issue. It was a governance issue, and that was one of the main reasons why this money was revoked.
Well, we can focus on Western State Hospital, but Emily, you pull back the camera and say this goes well beyond Western State when it comes to mental health treatment.
It does, and you know, Washington State is one of the worst when it comes to mental health treatment and access to beds. We have far too few beds for the people who are suffering from mental health crises, and that's why we see a lot of these folks on our streets here in the Puget Sound region, and you know, it has a cascade effect.
In the Cascade region.
And it goes all the way back to the Reagan administration when the mental health care was defunded. And I think that we're seeing that play out now. And this is just one small piece of a much, much bigger puzzle.
You know, I have to wonder if it has to do in part with the way that we view mentally ill people. Although it's pervasive and it affects so many families, I think there's a certain attitude about mentally ill people that doesn't treat them as folks who need help. Do you think that plays into it? When you see people on the street who are talking to themselves, et cetera, you get scared, you don't get sympathetic.
I think that sometimes does happen. And I think... There's also a dynamic where an individual can feel, you know, it's hopeless. And so, you know, we do keep seeing people who are acting out on the street. We do know people of people who are, maybe they're not acting out on the street, but they still suffer from and are incapacitated by their mental illness. And we who are not don't see the hope. And I think that also helps influence some of the decision making.
Well, how could they not be hopeless? I mean, we're still not dealing with this major issue here in Seattle. We're not dealing with it regionally, and we're not dealing it statewide.
So at the hospital, one stat sort of stuck out for me in this report, that a lot of the staffing comes down to folks who want to work or who end up working, I should say, 7 hours and 45 minutes instead of the full 8 hours. So have you ever been to any hospital? You know, one of the scariest moments of the whole experience is shift change, because there's a lot happens in a shift. And there's all this information that has to be translated to the next person coming in so they don't make a mistake. And if you have folks who are sort of halfway out the door talking to the next staff, I think that's just ripe for mistakes. And that's one of the things that they found.
Oh, do we, as journalists, tend to report the horrible incidents involving mentally ill people and perhaps inadvertently not report about the fact that there certainly are success stories?
Absolutely.
That's fair.
And therefore
place
a kind of a haze over it of this is awful and it can never be fixed. Nothing can ever go right.
Yes, I agree.
Do we have a plan? The last month, Governor Inslee announced a 5-year plan to start moving civilly committed patients out of Western State and into community treatment facilities. Going forward, the state's lost this $53 million in funding. Is there any hope for some change forthcoming?
Well, one of the things that's made that tougher and that also impacted things at Western State was this battle over the capital budget, because the capital budget was delayed for almost a year, and a lot of that money went to help build community mental health facilities. So, you know, the political fights, again, make it difficult to accomplish what the governor, what the legislature, what they would like to do. Even when the money is available, then they fight over delivering the money.
That's so interesting. I would not have connected the capital funding fight on something like this, on mental health, but obviously it is connected. Yeah.
I think it's to the governor's credit that this is at least his goal of something to do. That probably would make this, have some more better stories that you were talking about.
Well, and I think in the Seattle Times editorial, they said it's too little, too late. I disagree with that. I think
I do, too.
It's never too late. Let's fix this.
Right.
We really
it's
need
not,
to fix this.
It's not that. I disagree with that.
It does need to get fixed. Mm-hmm. That's for sure. Emily Parkhurst was with us, the editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal, Essex Porter reporter at Cairo 7 News, and Joni Balter, host of the Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. This is The Week in Review. Costs for Seattle's new downtown streetcar line have ballooned by 33% to $200 million. Mayor Jenny Durkan stopped work as news of the cost overruns came out. A review of the project was supposed to be done last week. I don't believe it came out this morning. We haven't seen it yet. Now there's talk about scrapping the streetcar line expansion. Emily Parkhurst with the Puget Sound Business Journal, you've been on this. What's the impact this delay is having on businesses?
Well, I can see the construction out my window, so it's easy for us to be on it. But the impact in Pioneer Square has been huge. If you kind of take a look at Pioneer Square from the 30,000 foot view, this neighborhood has been under construction for a decade. And a lot of businesses are trying to go in there. There's a real big push to build up the restaurants and the retailers there and fix up Occidental Square and make it a really pleasant place to be. But you can't even get there. Mm-hmm. You can't. You can't even take a right or a left on First Avenue. Half of it's closed.
Why would you want to take a right or a left on First Avenue? I don't even understand. No, I'm just
kidding. You're supposed to go to the restaurant, Tony.
I thought you were just supposed to go straight down, sit in the construction, and just call it a day.
That's what you do now.
I feel like halting construction on this was one of the best things the new mayor has done. And I think the next step is admitting and ending this sort of misery with this streetcar. And the thing is, look, I think they just play darts, these big dart games down at the Department of Transportation, where they throw darts at the wall and sort of guess what things cost, because they're that far off. They are just too far off. They need to compare this to the success or lack of it use of the other streetcars.
Now, I have some breaking news from the other perspective, because my colleague Graham Johnson is covering this for Cairo 7, and he just got an email from folks for the Alliance for Pioneer Square under the heading of Seattle Streetcar Coalition. It's a big group of folks who have sent a letter to the mayor saying the streetcar construction should continue. So,
Do they all ride it?
You can't ride it in Pioneer.
No, well, they ride the other ones.
Ride it to
I need
Pioneer
proof.
Square.
I need proof that they ride the other ones.
Well, I think right now one of the issues is that they don't go anywhere. And the idea with this one is to connect the South Lake Union one and the one that goes up to Capitol Hill. I do think people will
That's
ride
a
it.
Fantasy,
down.
As far as I'm concerned.
I'll personally ride it, but it will go by my office. And when it comes to the businesses down there, they're hurting. We talked to business owners who are saying revenue's down 15%. That's huge for a restaurant. They're not surviving. They're closing. Lots of restaurants have closed down in Pioneer Square because of the construction. And there's no end in sight. The viaduct's coming down next. Pioneer Square is going to get torn up again.
You know, Joni was suggesting kill it, like end the downtown streetcar. What do you think about that, Essex?
Well, I think one of the arguments certainly is that the other two halves of the streetcar system need to go somewhere. This is what connects them. And there is also deep concern that if you kill it, you are also perhaps killing other projects that will not get federal money, because the federal government has offered money for this one. If you say no and give the money back, you go down on the list for your other projects as well.
Yeah,
so it has a ripple effect.
If this project doesn't work, it doesn't work. And so, you know what's happened with the South Lake Union streetcar. It can't get through all the people. It was a good idea when it was a good idea, and then it doesn't have enough mobility attached to it. This one, this First Avenue one, is just so expensive. They have no idea what it costs, and they've been looking for weeks to figure out what it costs, and they still don't know. I think it's time to cut bait here.
Major conservative groups are pushing the notion nationally that mass transit, streetcars, et cetera, are passe in the era in which we might have self-driving cars, et cetera. Emily Essex, do you think that there's a point there?
You know, when you get in a self-driving car, they always tell you to keep paying attention. To me, it's not a self-driving car until I can take a nap. When do we get to that?
But are we building a 20th century solution in the 21st century when there might be other better solutions? Emily, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that we need to take that into account for sure. Mm. And I think that the companies that are building these, the Car2Go's, the ReachNow's, the Ubers, the Lyfts, they are planning their future with self-driving cars in mind. They are planning their businesses with self-driving cars in mind. And so we should be bringing them in, and they should be at that same table with SDOT and with WashDOT and with everybody, with Sound Transit, planning out the future. And I don't think that coordination is happening, and it should be.
And I don't see how you get around the self-driving traffic jam, right? It's still a car.
Well, and they're going to behave like bees, right? And they're all going to swarm together.
That's the argument.
Here's the advantage of the self-driving cars. At least they're not on the phone, you know what I mean? Like, they're trying. Well, the others are not even trying, the other drivers.
The streetcar cost overruns, the massive overruns on the bike lanes, the worsening situation with homelessness despite the big expenditures. I mean, these are legitimate news stories, but are there stories about the effective use of taxpayer money that we've overlooked, and is that casting a pall on everything that government does?
I think the transportation writers are so busy writing the stories that, this project's over, move Seattle, no idea what things cost there, that they haven't had time to tell the touchy-feely stories that you're mentioning.
Are they just touchy-feely stories? Are we getting a misapprehension of the transportation situation and other government expenditures because we only hear about when things go wrong? What do
so
you think?
So I will say, we did talk to Heather Marks, I believe was her name, and she's working for SDOT, trying to coordinate the construction that's going on in Pioneer Square and other areas, so that basically if we're going to lay a new sewer line, we're going to lay some new utility lines, and there's going to be a new streetcar put in there, that we do those in the correct order. So we don't have to dig up that street four times in order to pull that off. And believe it or not, this is a relatively new idea, and we're just trying it, and it seems to be working well. When we talked to the Alliance for Pioneer Square, they were saying that's been very successful.
That's one of the reasons the bike lanes were so expensive, because when they went in there, they didn't just draw, hey, let's take some white paint and say this is where the bike lane ends. They went in and they repurposed underground some of the,
And then they used cost accounting to attribute it to the bike lanes instead of separating it out. That's how you got a $12 million bike lane, because it didn't cost $12 million to build the bike lane.
We're talking about the Week in Review. That's Essex Porter. He's at Cairo 7 News. Joni Balter, also with us, host of the Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. And Emily Parkhurst, editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal. Coming up, we're going to talk about civility. Is President Trump's incivility infecting those who disagree with him? Maybe you've got some thoughts on that. You can tweet at us at KUOW. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds. It's the Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke with Emily Parkhurst, editor of the Puget Sound Business Journal, Essex Porter from Cairo 7 News, Joni Balter, host of the Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. We're taking a look at the news that's gone down in the past week, getting some perspectives on it, also asking for your perspectives on it. You can tweet at us at KUOW. And when you do, it will be received here, and Carrie McDermott will take a look at it, and she'll share some of your better bon mots with us on the air. That's at KUOW. Here's something that happened this week.
If you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. and you push back on them, and you tell them they're not welcome.
Healthy debate on ideas and political philosophy is important. But the calls for harassment and push for any Trump supporter to avoid the public is unacceptable.
When we in this democracy are suggesting that because we disagree with people on political views, on policy views, on philosophical views, that we should resort to violence and harassment and intimidation, that's dangerous for our society. It's dangerous for our democracy. She should apologize, and there's just no place for that in our public discourse.
If you want to talk about civility, you start with the President of the United States.
Maxine Waters, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and Paul Ryan talking about some reaction to some of the incidents that have been taking place recently. Trump spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders being asked to leave a Virginia restaurant after the cheese was served. Another Trump official shouted out of a Mexican restaurant by a group of people upset about the Trump immigration policy. And right here at home, Seattle Times columnist Danny Westney this week noted a Craigslist ad for a house share that said, "We will not accept anyone who voted for Trump." That's one of many. Taking all this in, Westney commented, "Liberals are losing their minds a little bit." He writes, Rather, they're letting Trump get inside their heads, which means he's winning. And Cairo Radio's Dave Ross wrote, "We're devolving into a nation of shame gangs." Are we shame ganging? Or at KUOW, tweet at us, "Does the decline in civility among Trump opponents, clearly triggered by Trump's lack of civility, mean that Trump is winning?"
Yeah, yes, it does. Absolutely. So look, with apologies to Michelle Obama here, you know, when Trump goes low, the Democrats are going to go lower. Is that what this is about? This doesn't happen to me often, but I agree with Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I just don't think you want to go and make people who work in Washington, D.C., you know, uncomfortable. They can't go to a restaurant. This is ridiculous. The Danny Westney column referred to the one or two Trump supporters in Seattle who might want to rent a house. This can't be like a big problem. You know what I mean? There's just not that many trying to rent rooms. But again, you know, what about respect for people of different viewpoints?
So is it unnecessarily uncivil to say we don't want any Trump supporters in this house share? What do you think, Emily?
I don't know. It's pretty rich that that the Republicans are getting up in arms about not allowing Trump supporters into restaurants when they don't want to allow gay people to buy cakes. But even that aside, I think that, you know, the question of civility, I get a little tired of that term, civility. I think if something is upsetting you about what the Trump administration is doing, you should be loud and vocal about it. That's what this country is all about, and that's why we have the First Amendment.
Chasing people out of restaurants?
But chasing people out of restaurants.
Well, who got chased out of a restaurant? You know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was actually taken aside to a private spot in that little restaurant and politely asked by the owner to leave. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was
chasing
not
her out of the restaurant.
Was not chased out of a restaurant.
But how embarrassing if it happened to U.S. exporter. You're in a restaurant with a group of people. You get pulled aside and said, "Please leave."
Well, it very well may be embarrassing. But remember, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is a volunteer. She's a volunteer paid by the taxpayers to promote the policies of the Trump administration, many of which a lot of people disagree with, including the part where children are kept in cages in old Walmarts in Texas. So if you are working for the Trump administration, just as if you are working for some other administration and you are the public face of that, you have volunteered to do that, and there may be, in some situations where you are told you are not welcome. There should be no violence attached to that.
Sure,
exactly.
I think we'd all agree on that, but is it a different situation when she's standing on the podium saying things in her official capacity versus she's out to eat at a restaurant?
Well, you know, she's the same person whether she's out to eat
right. Or
whether she's or whether she's at the podium. You know, and I don't recall Paul Ryan saying anything when Tea Party activists were literally spitting on civil rights icon John Lewis in Congress during the Tea Party activity over health care and other things back in the last decade.
So you
who's counting on Paul Ryan to lead us in some ethical or determined way? I certainly don't think that he's got any of that stuff. That's why he's got to go.
Yeah, I just don't think
even
you can
he
expect,
knows that.
I just don't think you can expect people who feel differently to sort of unilaterally disarm. The Republicans can bully and be as rude as they like.
I agree with that part. I agree.
People
with that
on the
part.
Other side must continue to be.
Well, so why be like that? Why join that?
So, do you? If they go low, do you go as low?
Well, that's what I. That's what I was about.
They're going lower. It seems like.
The bullying people into silence is not a good answer either, because then you end up with this silent majority, which is what happened at the last election. And we don't realize that people are feeling the way that they're feeling and as a result can't address some of the issues that they perceive, whether it's accurate or not, to be issues for them. And I think that that is kind of what we're talking about here. If you're saying we're not going to listen to you because you happen to be a Trump supporter, there's an issue there.
We don't even want you in the room.
Right.
We don't even want you as a roommate. We don't want to come near you.
Exactly. I think that's dangerous. I think that's dangerous for society.
I would ask, in a democracy, can we even take steps forward if we're so polarized we can't even talk or much less begin a conversation? Essex?
You know, ultimately, a conversation has to be promoted, has to be done. But I think some of the counter-protests you might be seeing from people on the left is not based on what people are saying, but are based on what people are doing, what people are enabling. It's not just a matter of talking.
We've been monitoring what your tweets at us at KUOW, and Karen McDermott's been taking a look. Anything interesting coming over? Any thoughts on this issue of civility and incivility?
Yes, we had one person tweet at us, "Bigotry is not a political view. Choosing not to share a home with a bigot is protecting oneself. People who choose to be bigots should not be normalized. It's our duty to stand up to them." And another one said, "All of us are civic volunteers in choosing to hold and advocate the positions that we hold. Rules of civility do not allow for exceptions just because someone is a public official."
Well, an interesting point there. So if you're a Trump supporter, I mean, certainly if you're a supporter of some politicians, does that mean you support everything that they do? And you could argue that some of Trump's policies are bigoted. You might support Trump for other reasons other than that. But are you lumped into, if you ally yourself with a political leader, are you allied with everything that they say?
Well, yes and no, because voting matters. And sort of when you vote for somebody, you sort of buy into what they do. You know, to me, this is like this vicious cycle or vicious circle, not sure which. Where you have this sort of intolerance. It's just an incredible amount of intolerance. And it does sort of start at the top. And then, you know, it's what we talked about earlier. It's Mitch McConnell saying he would not respect President Obama's Supreme Court nominee for whatever it was, like 10 months, that, you know, can't be done, changing the rules like that. So one bit of intolerance breeds the next bit of intolerance, and pretty soon this thing doesn't work.
And here's where presidential leadership can make a difference. If Donald Trump can change his bullying ways, can truly reach out and listen, can stop calling names, that can help lead the nation.
That I absolutely agree with. You know, this president has set all kinds of records for being, you know, disgusting and disrespectful and lowering the bar of what we expect from a president. Imagine the kids watching this guy like, hey, if you lie all day, you'll get ahead in the world. Try that for a while. Forget what your parents told you.
Well, by the way, Seattle does protect against discrimination based on political ideology. Seattle, the District of Columbia, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. So that makes me wonder whether someone who's keeping out a Trump supporter from sharing their house is ever going to be affected by the law. You're listening to Week in Review on KUOW. Finally today, blowing bubbles in your milk is about to get a whole lot more environmentally friendly. Seattle's ban on single-use plastics goes into effect on Sunday. Plastic straws, forks, spoons, sporks, they're gone. When Seattle banned plastic bags a few years ago, my supermarket started selling heavy-duty plastic bags and calling them recyclable. Are we going to have a similar loophole here? Are people going to try to get through this?
I think that technology is there already. You can have, they have all these biodegradable products. You can buy the biodegradable version. Sometimes you can't even tell the difference, right? And that will happen to straws if we really, really need straws to seem like they're...
Well, Essex and Emily, where do you stand on the straw issue? Do you even need straws? What do we need straws for?
Well, you know, actually people do need straws. Not everyone can easily hold up a cup or a glass and you know, and it's sometimes, you know, just for all of us, especially those of us with children, it's nice to have that plastic top covering the drink and have the child sip through the straw. You know, if we can have a straw that is less environmentally damaging, I'm all for it.
Emily?
Yeah, I'm with Essex there. There is definitely times when straws are really great. If you've got a group of 6-8-year-old boys in a pizza shop, you want all of those cups covered with straws, covered and when them with straws in them. But it, you know, there's a huge environmental impact from all of this disposable silverware. So I think it's a good move. But the challenge is going to be to get all the businesses in town to make that switch. A lot of them already have. This was something that the city instituted a while ago, and so a lot of them have already been doing this. The thing that's really confusing to me, though, as a consumer, I've been asking all the restaurants when I go in, so is this straw compostable or is it not? Because I can't tell the difference.
Right.
They look exactly the same. And I'm not entirely convinced that everybody who's working there even knows the answer.
Well, can we get to the really serious issue here? If we're going to replace plastic straws, what happens to the bendy straw? I mean, is it the end of
I think
the
you
oh,
can
no, you
probably
can have
make
plastic
that.
Bendy
you
straws.
Can, you can make that. You can
I feel like the
and
technology
you can have paper
exists.
Bendy straws, yeah.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. You've been listening to Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Special thanks to our guests, Emily Parkhurst, Essex Porter, and Joni Balter. Monday, Bill Radke's back. He'll tell you how you can use science fiction to tell the future. Please join us. This is KUOW Seattle.
Thank you.